Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, screenwriter and author Nicholas Meyer discusses his latest mystery novel, Sherlock Holmes and the Real Thing. Meyer is interviewed by Allison Sansoni, the AWM's program director. This conversation originally took place September 18th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing tonight? Thank you for coming. We're glad you're here. We hope you get a few minutes to walk around and enjoy the museum as well, before and or after the program. If you like the kind of programs that we do here at the American Writers Museum, you can become a member and get free admission and discounted tickets to our programs and special events, including our monthly happy hour series, Get Lit, and our upcoming special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which opens in November. I want to thank everybody for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. The author for tonight is a very special author named Nicholas Myers. He's the author of 7 previous novels, including The 7% Solution, a Doyle tale in which Sherlock Holmes met Sigmund Freud. The novel sold more than 2 million copies, stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 40 weeks, and won the British Gold Dagger Award for the British Crime Writers Association. And 2 years later, Meyer received an Academy Award nomination for his screenplay of the film. Meyer made his directing debut in 1979 with a film he wrote, Time After Time, starring Malcolm McDowell, Mary Steenburgen, and David Warner. He went on to write and direct Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Other directing and credits include Volunteers, Company Business, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and the HBO film Vendetta. His screenplays include Summersby and contributions to Fatal Attraction and DreamWorks' Prince of Egypt. He's with us tonight to talk about his latest Sherlock Holmes novel, Sherlock Holmes and the Real Thing, interviewed by program director Allison Sansoni. So please welcome Nicholas Meyers.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being with us, and thank you for being with us this evening.
Just happened by.
I wanted to get started by asking you a little bit about where this book finds Holmes and Watson, where they are in their lives and their friendship, where they begin when the book begins.
Well, all 7 of my novels I've managed to fit into where more or less accepted Holmesian chronology, and there's heated debate about where some of these stories actually belong. There are, in fact, 60 stories in total, 56 short stories and 4 novellas, and they pretty much sort of parallel what Doyle was writing when he was writing, but he moved them around, and he didn't always keep everything straight, hence all the arguments about the chronology and where this story happened and where that. If there are 2 annotated complete Sherlock Holmes, one by William S. Baring Gould and one more recently by Leslie Klinger, and they don't always agree. So you sort of pays your money and takes your choice. I've tried to fit my stories into what I think are the spaces where they might properly be placed. This story, which is in itself questions, or the editor, which turns out to be me, questions whether this is an authentic story or not. The subject here is forgery, so it's fitting that we're questioning whether it's authentic or not. I think it takes place in the late 1890s. I have a specific year in mind, but I'm not telling.
So this book takes place in the high-profile art world that existed in that purposely vague time period.
It still exists.
Yeah.
The art world is very mean and dirty.
What were you reading about? What were you finding out about when you began researching that world? Information that you put forward in the book, was it something you already knew, an area you were familiar with, or did you have to go exploring?
The origin of this book took place in late 1974 or 1975 when my book, The 7% Solution, was a big hit book. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. This is back when everybody read books instead of looking at their phones. And I got sent on a book tour. And back then, if it was a best-selling book, the publisher paid for the tour. This is no longer the case. And I arrived in Pittsburgh through a very bad thunderstorm, and I was met at the airport by a young reporter about my age who clearly thought this assignment was unworthy of him to interview a kid author. And he began by saying, "How does it feel to be a successful forger?" And I, who was still trying to settle my stomach, could only sort of gape at him. And when I recovered some self-possession, I said, well, it doesn't actually say by Nicholas Meyer. It says as edited by Nicholas Meyer. So I'm not claiming to be the author, but it was a remark that rankled, and I went to sleep in some strange hotel room that night and think, well, I guess I am a forger. And that was where my interest in forgery began. And at that point, I didn't really know much about it, but I instantly found that I had stepped into a labyrinth, fittingly enough, because forgery, as it turns out, poses a whole host of questions, legal questions, ethical questions, aesthetic questions, cultural questions, even verbal questions. What's the difference, for example, between a forgery and a copy? Something you can't see, the intention. A copy announces itself. It's labeled. I'm a reproduction. I'm a copy. You can buy me at the museum store. Forgery tries to insist that it's the real thing. What's the difference between a forger and a plagiarist? They're opposite sides of the same coin, right? A plagiarist tries to make you believe that somebody else's work is theirs, and a forger tries to make you believe that their work is somebody else's. So there are rabbit holes after rabbit holes, and then there's a whole other category which the French call à la manière de, in the manner of. So if you go on AI now and say, paint me a Vincent van Gogh, they'll give you something that's in the style of, but not exactly a copyrightable copy of, in the manner of. And so a lot of times people have made a career out of painting sort of look-alike paintings that aren't exactly the same, and people have forged plays that aren't exactly the same. There was a man named Ireland, I think, who found missing Shakespeare plays back in the day. I'm trying to remember who his first name was, but they staged one of these plays with great fanfare, and it was so wretched and interminable. Sometimes these things do give themselves away, but oftentimes, by the way, they don't. And how many times have you stood before a painting in a museum or somebody's home and been deeply moved by what you are experiencing, or a piece of music for that matter, or a piece of literature? It's called the Stendhal effect, named for the author who called himself Stendhal, and in which you are so profoundly shaken or deeply moved by a work of art, some kind of art. And when you find out that it is not authentic, does that somehow invalidate your profound emotional response? It's getting very messy, isn't it? It's getting messy, this whole forgery business. Anyway, I started reading about it and collecting and reading about How many people here have ever seen Orson Welles' movie F for Fake? Okay. The rest of you, don't sleep. Go home and find F for Fake. It's not a long movie. It's about an hour and 20 minutes. And what Orson Welles discovered was that there were two characters living on the island of Ibiza, one of whom was a famous forger named Elmire de Hori, whose Modiglianis and Picassos probably are still hanging on a lot of walls. The other was his biographer, an American named Clifford Irving. If this name is vaguely familiar, you may recall Clifford Irving as the fake author of Howard Hughes' diaries, another scandal. He obviously was inspired by Elmire de Hori, whose biography he was writing. Anyway, Orson Welles said, what are the odds of these two fakers living on the same Ibiza place? And I think the BBC had started to make a movie about Elmire de Hori, and there was a lot of footage they'd never used. So he acquired it, spliced himself in strategically. You won't be sorry, F for Fake. A lot of very interesting stuff. So I just kept collecting this stuff and collecting this stuff. And when my publisher offered me a two-book deal, the previous one being Sherlock Holmes and the Telegram from Hell, which is about the Zimmerman telegram, and that came out last year, but he wanted another book, and I had no idea what the other book should be about, but he was offering money, so I said yes. And then in very surprisingly little time, I think I crossed the street, and I said, oh, I could do a book about forgery.
It seems like such a natural thing for a Sherlock Holmes figure to become obsessed with, because as you said, there's rabbit hole after rabbit hole, and there are all of these different, there is so much information that you need to gather. So, I mean, in the book, he's studying up on this and he's learning all about this.
Yes. Yeah. The reader goes on the same journey. I don't know if I planned it that way. It's hard to remember what you planned. How many people here have read Edgar Allan Poe's The Philosophy of Composition? Anybody read The Philosophy of Composition? The creative process is a mysterious process. The Oracle at Delphi says to Socrates that he's the wisest man in Greece, and Socrates says, well, that can't be right. So all I need to do to disprove is to meet somebody wiser than me. So he goes talking to all levels of Greek society until he finally gets around to the poets. And I think by poets, we probably mean artists. And back then, they were probably all guys. And he figured, surely these men who write and sculpt and paint so insightfully about the human condition are going to prove to be wiser than me. Just imagine my surprise when I found that the poets were the stupidest people that I spoke to.
Oh, no.
They were like children, he said, except when they did their art. And then they go into a kind of trance, during which time they take dictation from God, and this they call inspiration. And then when it's over, they go back to being jerks again. So artists, and by the way, Plato did not want writers in the Republic because we're liars. So which brings us back to Poe and the philosophy of composition. He said, a lot of people ask me how I create. So I'm going to tell you how I created my most famous poem, The Raven. And it was just a matter of logic. That's all it was. First decision, I wanted to write a poem. Second decision, how long should the poem be? He said, I believe that a work of art to be successful should be appreciable at one sitting. That's why I never wrote novels and I never wrote long poems. I just short stories and poems. He faults Milton's Paradise Lost because it's too long. So I wanted to write a poem. I picked 100 lines long. The Raven is 108. Next, what is the subject of the poem? I believe, says Poe, that the proper province of poetry is the contemplation of the beautiful. Everything else is prose. So I now had a 100-line poem about something beautiful. What's the greatest kind of beauty I could think of? Sad beauty. What's the saddest beauty I could think of? Death. Whose death was the saddest I could imagine? The death of a maiden. I now had a 100-line poem about the death of a maiden. Next, I wanted a refrain, a chorus, a sentence, maybe even a word. What was the saddest word I could think of? Nevermore. Okay, I now had a 100-line poem about the death of a maiden, and the refrain is nevermore. Nevermore is an answer. So somebody's asking questions. Who could that be? This is a no-brainer. The lover of the dead maiden. Okay, who's answering? That got trickier because it's always coming out the same. Nevermore, nevermore, nevermore. Doesn't sound quite human. So he thought of a parrot. But a parrot is a comical bird, so he rejected the parrot in favor of a raven, which can mimic apparently human speech. I now had a 100-line poem about the death of a maiden with a raven answering the lover of the dead girl, never, this remorseless nevermore. And now we also begin to understand something of the psychology of the lover who perversely frames his questions to elicit the only answer of which the raven is capable. Next, where do you put the lover and the raven together? First, I wanted to put it, he said, in the woods, in the raven's milieu, but this seemed to lack some of the voluptuous, claustrophobic intensity that I was after, so I stuck the lover in his study, and the raven is tap, tap, tapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered. "Only this and nothing more," quoth the raven. And so he says, this is how I wrote the raven. Now, folks, there's four possibilities here. One, this is how Poe thinks he wrote the raven. Two, this is how he, no, number one is this is how he wrote the raven. Two is, this is how he thinks he wrote the raven. Three, this is how he wishes he had written the raven. And four, this is how he would like you to think he wrote the raven. The answer is very possibly an amalgam of all these. I don't know. But it goes back to Plato not wanting us in the Republic because we're going to make up shit in order to explain. Gilbert said that he wrote the Mikado because there was a Japanese sword hanging over his desk and it fell down, almost decapitated him. It's a good story. Maybe it's even true. It simply doesn't explain how he wrote the Mikado. And so when you ask, when anybody asks, I kind of go, I don't know. I started with an idea. I wanted it to be full circle, bring it back to London, because previously Holmes had been to Vienna to see Freud, or he'd been to Russia, or he'd been to Paris, and in the previous one he went to America and Mexico City. So I thought, bring it back to sort of basics. And I think plotting for me is a little bit like headlights on a car. You can see enough ahead to where the next bit is going to go, and then you hope the headlights will illumine the next bit. The nice thing about computers is if you understand that the business of writing is rewriting, computers make that much easier than when you had to get out the scissors and the scotch tape and the liquorice and all for one comma. And if you are not by nature a perfectionist, and I'm not, the computer enables you to indulge perfectionist tendencies because you don't have to do all the mechanical stuff with the scotch tape. I've forgotten your question, but I think this is my answer.
Well, I'm honestly afraid to ask the next one after the Raven story, but it's, what is it that about Sherlock Holmes that draws you back to this character over and over? What is it about this character, the setting, the world that allows you to continue to find new stories there?
Well, what's interesting is that I'm not the only person who's obviously fixated by Sherlock Holmes. Doyle wrote a lot of other stuff. He placed great store by his historical novels, and they're not bad. The White Company and Rodney Stone. Also his science fiction, The Lost World, Dinosaurs on a Plateau in South America. And he worked really hard. It's a little bit interesting about artists who feel they are appreciated for the wrong thing, and they're disappointed or embittered or pissed off. Arthur Sullivan, who was the shining white hope of English music, the English Mendelssohn, he wrote this grand opera, Ivanhoe. We all know how often that's revived. But what is he remembered for? He's remembered for Gilbert and Sullivan, those, or maybe Onward Christian Soldiers, a hit tune. But he was always annoyed, and Doyle was annoyed that people preferred these Sherlock Holmes stories that he tossed off, he claimed, in about a week. It's interesting to look at the manuscripts. There are two basic kinds of creativity. We'll call them the Mozart method and the Beethoven method. Mozart liked to write music in his head while he was shooting pool. He was apparently a good pool player, and he would be shooting pool, and at the end out would come one of 27 piano concertos. And if you look at the Mozart manuscripts, there are very few corrections. If you look at Doyle manuscripts, very few corrections. It was all going on in here. All you have to do is look at Beethoven's sketchbooks, and there are sketchbooks, to see the whole process hideously externalized. It looks like a demented chicken crossing the staff paper, and you go, my God, this guy went through the tortures of the damned to figure out, bop, 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 bop. You know, can you imagine all the different variations before he found it? So, what were we talking about?
We were talking about what particularly about Sherlock Holmes and his world speaks to you.
Well, it speaks to everybody, and the you know why. The only thing it reminds me of, and this is just one person's opinion, is Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. I think they're the prototype. Quixote, like Holmes, is a deducer. He explains to Sancho what things really are. That's not a windmill. That's a giant. And Sancho, who is not stupid, as Watson is not stupid, they're just regular, and they enjoy the company, the society of Don Quixote, or he calls himself Don Quixote, and Watson enjoys and is revified by being in the company of Holmes, and I think we enjoy being in their company. There's something reassuring about them. They are civilized. There are aspects of Holmes that we don't like. He's a racist, and he is something of an anti-Semite. These are not things that I choose to replicate in my forgeries, but I'm faced, I'm wandering far afield, but I do remember the question this time. That's something.
I trust you.
You shouldn't. all works of art are ineluctably products of the time in which they are created. Mozart doesn't just sound like Mozart, he sounds like mid-18th century Middle European music. Renoir doesn't just look like Renoir, he looks like late 19th century French Impressionism. If I were to show you five movies, all allegedly or deliberately set in the year 1776, and one movie was made in 1920, and one movie was made in 1940, and one movie was made in 1980, and another movie was in 2010, you would be able to tell within 5 minutes, 5 years, when those movies were made. Are they black and white? Are they silent? Do they have color, sound? How long are the eyelashes on the ladies? What are the political sentiments and ideals are expressed or left out, and so forth? You could figure it out. The problem for forgers is that forgery also is inevitably also the product of the time in which it is created. So I try to imitate Arthur Conan Doyle, but Holmes has become somewhat my avatar. He's the ventriloquist's dummy, and the sentiments that are being expressed, even if I halfway get the language right, are not always the sentiments of Arthur Conan Doyle between 1887 and his death in 1930. The other things leak out. And for example, the great forger of Vermeers was another Dutchman named Han van Meegeren. Has anybody come across this guy? His forgeries, which were done in the 20s or the 30s, were bought up as Vermeers by museums and millionaires all over the place, including Hermann Göring, paid a fortune for one of van Meegeren's Vermeers. The problem is that when you look at them today, they stink. They look like Art Deco, because forgery too is the product of the time in which it is created. I don't know why Sherlock and Watson are so popular. They exist in a world that's far enough away from our own to have a kind of fairy tale or romanticized, whatever we think the Victorians were, with some of the less appetizing spots kind of blurred out a little bit, but also close enough to our own time that we can sort of follow along. They got telephones, they got telegraphs, and even at one point they have an automobile. So it's not impossible that we can sort of relate to them on these two levels.
To continue with the forgery theme, throughout your career you've taken established characters, Holmes and Watson, Kirk, Spock, Moses, and written them yourself. How do you approach what is the spirit with which you approach those characters? How well do you get to know their previous incarnations? How much of that voice is, that ventriloquist voice is yours?
That's a really good question, and will prompt another long-winded answer, I'm afraid. I think it depends on which character you're dealing with, and a kind of gut intuition about where you can go, what you can make them do, and what you can't make them do. Doyle himself was responsive to this, or obliged. For example, in the First World War, as we know, a lot of people died. People lost fathers, brothers, sons. They lost a lot of men, a whole generation. And with it came the rise of spiritualism. A lot of people on Ouija boards communicating with the dead, including, as of 1916, Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. And he had lost a brother, a brother-in-law, and a son in World War I, or because of World War I, and therefore it was not astonishing that he too joined the ranks, and did so for the rest of his life, of the spiritualists. But he never made Sherlock Holmes an apologist or a proselytizer for those beliefs. As Holmes says to Watson, "This agency stands flat-footed on the ground. Neither of us, I take it, are prepared to admit diabolical intrusions into the affairs of men. No ghosts need apply." So there are limits to what you can do depending on with whom you're doing them. When I was working on my Star Trek movies, either 2, 4, and 6, especially with 2, I didn't know anything about Star Trek. I had never really watched it, and I sort of typical me, I missed everything that was important about it. And there are things that are important about it. So I just, you know, I thought, what does this remind me of that I do know? And I remember, another tangent, I think that childhood experiences are sometimes the most deeply felt, the most lasting. We call it an impressionable age. When I was a kid, I'm 11 years old, my dad gave me the complete Sherlock Holmes at an impressionable age. When I was about 13, I was reading books by a guy who called himself C.S. Forrester, and these were the adventures of Captain Horatio Hornblower,
of course,
a captain in the Royal Navy during the Napoleonic Wars. And he had a lot of adventures, and he had a girl in every port. And if you're 13, that sounds pretty good. maybe it's still, well, anyway. I didn't know how to relate to Star Trek at first, but I did think, whoa, Kirk reminds me of Hornblower. This is Hornblower in outer space. I bet I could do that. And so when I was working on Kirk as a pre-established fictional character, or Spock, who bears a striking resemblance to Sherlock Holmes, which I even intimated in Star Trek VI when he quotes one of his ancestors, who's obviously Holmes, and people always go, "Hey." So I just kind of made Kirk into a space-going Captain Horatio Hornblower. Sometimes you can do this, and sometimes there are certain limitations and what you owe to fidelity and how much you can stretch is a variable. It's very hard. It depends on judgment and a lot of intangible musing, I think. That was my shortest answer.
I imagine it also depends on whether the progenitor is still alive and whether the work is under copyright.
Ah, copyright. When I wrote the 7% solution, somebody said, "Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise." I thought they were out of copyright. I'm not good with numbers. and so I wrote it, and then I found out, well, he is in copyright, and the Conan Doyle estate was the meanest, most avaricious, greedy bunch of people, and they didn't care anything about Sherlock Holmes. They loved money. And so the solution was not a 7% one, I can tell you. just to give you an example of their method of operation, they don't exist for practical purposes. Sherlock is in the public domain. Everybody can write their own Sherlock Holmes story. But what they do is they wait until someone's movie is about to come out, and then they hit them with some threat of copyright bullshit. And you could take them to court and you'd win, but it would cost you more than it would cost them to just write a check for $10,000 and say, "Go away," which is what they normally have done. But since Les Klinger, the author of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, he took them to court and he broke them. So now Holmes is, for better or worse, fair game.
Who are some of the writers, either in the Sherlock Holmes space or elsewhere, who are some of the writers whose work you find compelling or interesting who are working today?
Well, I have to preface my answer, my God, there's a preface, that I'm a real purist. I only like Holmes the way he is, where Arthur Conan Doyle wrote him and where I read him when I was 11. I hate most Sherlock Holmes movies. I particularly hate Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce because I never could understand why a genius hangs out with a jerk. It just didn't make any sense. And I could not believe that the character as depicted by Nigel Bruce actually wrote down the cases. It didn't track in some way. When I wrote the 7% solution, as much as anything else, I was attempting a kind of corrective to a lot of things that I didn't like in various movies. There are some movies that are fun. I don't know if you've seen Without a Clue, where Watson is the smart one and Holmes is the dummy. That's really good. I like The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. There are some that I like. And everybody has their own favorite image of who Sherlock Holmes is, the same way we have our own image of who Hamlet is. Years ago, the Lone Ranger went on tour, and they did Wild West show things for kids and rope tricks, and at the end, he unmasked. And it was always a disaster, kids yelling down, "That ain't him!" Because we all know who's behind the mask. We all know who Holmes really is, who Hamlet really is. So when you get into who's your favorite, Holmes tricky, you know. I wonder what Peter O'Toole would have been like. I wonder what Daniel Day-Lewis would be like. I did like Benedict Cumberbatch in the first two seasons, which I thought were very imaginative. And they weren't replicas of Doyle. They were inspired riffs on it, I guess. But to give you an idea of just what a purist I was, I went into a meeting with a producer to write a screenplay about a Sherlock Holmes movie that they were going to make. And this was at Paramount. And I said, what's the idea? And he said, well, it's about how Sherlock and Watson meet in high school. And I said, no, they didn't.
Oh.
So that was the end of my experience.
I don't know if you missed out on too much with that one.
I know, and I don't watch a lot of them. I really don't. And by the way, there are people who do very good Sherlock Holmes novels. I seldom read them because I'm so insecure. I think they're probably better, and then I'll just feel bad. Lindsay Fay does very good Sherlock Holmes. That scared me off, but not so much otherwise.
If there's a part you'd like to share with us, please.
Is that okay if I read a little snippet, just kind of to whet everybody's appetite? And you'll have to forgive the fact that I don't have a British accent that would pass muster, or pass mustard, as the case may be. In this novel, Holmes sends Watson to an art gallery. This is about the mysterious disappearance of an artist, not even a great artist, but he hasn't paid his rent. That's where this all starts. And in the course of investigating, Watson meets the niece of the gallery owner who works in the gallery, and he falls in love, and he feels bad because he hasn't been quite upfront as to what he was doing in the gallery in the first place, if you get my meaning. And there, Holmes and Watson are at their lodgings at Baker Street. We were interrupted by a knock on the door. "What is it, Mrs. Hudson?" Our landlady was holding a telegram. The detective held out his hand. "The telegram is addressed to Dr. Watson," she explained, giving it to me. Was it my imagination, or did I detect a certain smugness in her reply? Trying to conceal my excitement, I tore open the envelope, then reached for my hat and coat. "Holmes, I must ask you to accompany me. I am presently engaged, as you see, my dear fellow." "Holmes," I said sternly, causing him to look up. "In our years together, I have seldom asked you for anything, and it may be fairly said that I have toiled mightily on your behalf. Now I am asking for this." I handed him the telegram, which he read aloud. Quote, "Meet me at the National Gallery at 4. Stop. Bring your friend if he exists. Stop. J.P. That's Juliet Packwood, the name of the lady in question. He looked up from the telegram to the canvas and finally to me. "I am asking you, Holmes." There was a fractional pause. "Of course, my dear man." We arrived as Big Ben was tolling the hour. Juliet Packwood was waiting for us on the steps of the National Gallery, her tall, slender figure silhouetted before the imposing building. "Come, we have not much time before closing. Let us look at some pictures, and I will explain more, though I'm not sure either of you deserve it. Without waiting to see if we followed, she marched smartly up the steps and into the museum, pausing only to exchange looks. The detective and I traipsed behind through a labyrinth of more art than I ever beheld in my life. The place seemed to go on for miles, conveying the curious impression that the building was larger inside than out. When Henry VIII began the Protestant faith, in order to obtain his divorce, Juliet Packwood began in the manner of a tour guide speaking quietly over her shoulder. He succeeded in cutting England off from Catholic Europe for nearly 100 years. The unforeseen result was that England almost entirely missed the Renaissance. As she spoke, we passed pictures from various epochs and a bewildering array of styles. For better part of a century, therefore, England knew nothing of Da Vinci, remained in ignorance of Raphael, Caravaggio, Titian, Rubens, Botticelli, or Michelangelo. All we had was Holbein the Younger, she concluded with a rueful expression, gesturing as if on cue to the German painter's portrait of stout King Henry. When relations between Protestant England and the Catholic continent finally thawed, England began to see what she had missed. The reigning monarch, Charles I, most especially became enamored of Renaissance nudes. Yes, naked women were purchased by the cartload from Italy by agents of His Majesty for his private apartments at Whitehall Palace, where only he could revel in them. The nucleus of what you see here in the National Gallery originated as Charles Stuart's private property. You know from your schoolboy history, Charles I provoked a civil war, which ended when Oliver Cromwell chopped off his head. The late king's art collection was now property of the Puritan Commonwealth, whose first impulse was to burn these impious images. But wiser, unsevered heads prevailed. The civil war had bankrupted the country, and it was thought the painting's potential monetary value might help defray the expenses of the war. This may not have been history's first, but was certainly its biggest art sale. She turned and resumed walking without waiting to enjoy our astonishment. Here is a painting by the Italian master Botticelli. Do you observe anything unusual? The image was of another provocative nude, but it took only moments to understand why she had halted before it. But, I stammered, this woman, yes, what about her? Miss Packwood crossed her arms. This time I had no need to attempt a blush, for I felt myself reddening. This woman is you. Gotcha.
We have time for a couple of questions. If you could, those of you in the room, if you could wait for the microphone to come to you so that folks who are online are able to hear your question.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is a cattywampus one, since you said you didn't read other, I guess, Sherlock Holmes stuff, but I remember I have two. Mark Frost wrote The List of Seven and The Six Messiahs, which...
Say that again slowly.
I'm sorry about that. The author Mark Frost wrote The List of Seven and The Six Messiahs, which dealt with Arthur Conan Doyle, using his life and these weird adventures to supply those stories. And but that came out in, like, I think, 93 or 4, and I didn't know if you read any of, were familiar, because people know Mark Frost for doing Twin Peaks, but they don't know he also wrote.
I know him from doing Twin Peaks. I did not know that he was writing Conan Doyle stories.
It would be Conan Doyle, using Conan Doyle in an adventure setting. So those adventures he would use for writing.
Are they good?
Yes, they are, but it's not like Sherlock Holmes. It's mostly just him filling in a lot of cool adventure stuff, action. It's very good. I like it, but it's not...
The whole history of art, all art, is a history of cut and paste.
Yeah.
All fiction is fanboy stuff. The Odyssey is a fanboy sequel to the Iliad. The Aeneid is a fanboy sequel to the Odyssey. Mozart reorchestrates the Messiah. People add and subtract and do all kind of stuff. Sometimes when I'm reading a book or watching a movie, I think, oh, this is what you call a this better be good movie, you know, where you're waiting for the payoff and hoping that it's worthy of the incredible setup. You know, it's, somebody said, well, who's your favorite fictional detective? And I said, I think Oedipus. Oedipus says, I've solved the riddle of the Sphinx. I can figure out who murdered King Laius at the crossroads. And everybody tells him in the best Agatha Christie tradition, if you know what's good for you, don't poke your nose in this. And Oedipus insists. And then he finds out in a Agatha Christie twist that the murderer he's been looking for is himself. That's a this better be good story if I ever heard one.
If you could have one piece of Sherlockiana free, it's yours, what would it be?
You know, up till now I've been playing tapes. So that's why I can sort of, you know, you're asking me to think, which is not my specialty. One piece of Sherlockiana. Well, it wouldn't be the deerstalker hat, which I have to say I've never worn a deerstalker hat. I'm sort of superstitious.
We can run out and get one if you'd like to remedy that.
Not necessary, but maybe his houndstooth coat. I like with the sort of shoulder thing. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that. I think I'm too short to actually bring it off. No pun intended. Sherlock was tall, and I am, you may have noticed, less so. But I think maybe the coat. I would take the coat.
So you talked about the cinematic renditions over the years. I don't think you mentioned Robert Downey Jr. as Sherlock Holmes, did you?
I don't think I did.
And what is your... Okay, I'm just making sure that I didn't miss that. If you wouldn't mind sharing your... I assume you saw those films.
I've seen some of them. I don't know if I've seen all of them.
And what did you think?
Well, I admired them up to a point, which is to say I found the cinematic energy in the translation to be original and compelling. The idea that he could be kickboxing, we all know he was a champion kickboxer, that he could sort of, you saw these diagrams of where he was anticipating. I thought, well, that was really cool. And in some broad sense, and I also like the depiction of Watson as not just, you know, a jerk again, going for the easy laugh. But the stories I didn't think they weren't up to snuff. I don't think they knew how to do stories. What was good about, I thought, the Benedict Cumberbatch stuff in the first two seasons, where they took the Holmes original stories, and sort of reworked them in a contemporary setting, but they were still telling. I love that when you meet Irene Adler in that story, A Scandal in Bohemia, she's stark naked through the whole thing. I thought, yeah, you've got my full attention. Anyway, yeah, so you could say, and this goes back to all art being products of the time in which it is created, that every age is going to get some version of the Sherlock that it sort of deserves. And if we're all on our cell phones and our attention spans are short, then every movie's, the splices have to get shorter and shorter. You find me a shot in a what's his, Guy Ritchie movie that lasts longer than 4 seconds, and I'll be impressed. It's bam, 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 which isn't quite sort of the world in which I see Holmes. But I says up to a point, it's an imaginative reimagining, if you like. It's probably just not my thing. And again, it's a this better be good movie. And I never thought that the stories that they've come up with so far for Holmes to be involved with, I'm sure they've plenty of actions and they're scenically impressive because you can do anything now, but they don't necessarily have the satisfaction of the mystery or in some senses the charm, the warmth of these characters and their relationship.
Well, I think we're out of time, so thank you very, but thank you all very much for being here, and thank you very much, Nicholas Meyer, for sharing all of that with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.